This is an interview with Carl Plumley for the Montana Historical Society and Corps of Engineers Oral History Project on Fort Peck Dam and its construction. In this interview, Carl discusses his work as a transmission line surveyor, electrical inspector, dredge engineer, and chief dredge engineer on the Fort Peck project during the 1930s. The date of the interview was July the 31st, 1987. It was conducted in the dining hall of the Fort Peck Hotel. The interviewer is Lori Mercier.
Before I came to Fort Peck, I had been out of university 3 years, and I had been engaged with the Montana Power Company for almost 2 years on the construction and operation of natural gas systems. But then I found myself out of a job, and I went back to Montana State for 1 year of postgraduate study, which is, I chose instead of trying for a master's degree in electrical engineering, which was my bachelor's degree. I elected to take a broader base, courses in civil engineering, mechanical engineering, courses in economics and public speaking, and I actually obtained a certificate to teach. My whole objective was to broaden my base for getting a job. So when that year was finished, the next opportunity I had was again to do some surveying work on the project which became Fort Peck Dam. If you want to go any farther back than that, it's my school days in a country school near Manhattan, Montana. 4 years in high school at Manhattan, Montana, and then 4 years at Montana State University, then called Montana State College. I elected to take the engineering course because there were just two basic options: agriculture and engineering. And I had my fill of agriculture, having lived on a farm where we just didn't really make it. Even though the farmland is part of the best in the state, and it was irrigated. But it was a combination between the wars, First World War I, First World War II. We had extremely low wheat prices and extreme drought. And it all resulted in my dad losing his farm. Anyway, I was not disposed to an agricultural career. I chose electrical.
Well, how were you able to attend college first place?
I went to school the first year with all the potatoes that I had raised on a 2-acre plot that my dad set aside. He said, whatever you can get out of it, that's what you can take to college. And I think it amounted to $300. I worked all my way through school, and it's not easy. I wouldn't recommend it. I think later on when my children went to school, I encouraged them to work, but they didn't have to do it all. But I had to do it all. And I did everything, anything. Babysitting, to working in the fields for the farmers on weekends. I ended, finally, one job I did was unique. I was the nighttime operator of a chick hatchery. I would go, all the free time I had in the daytime from college, I went there. To candle eggs and put them in the incubator. Every evening, I went there to stay all night to fire the furnace. It was miserable. I would fire the furnace and go to sleep on a cot. And after 2 hours, I must get up again and fire the furnace again and take out the shells from the chicks that were hatching. And this was a routine. And after about 2 months of that, I guess, I decided it wasn't worth it. I would quit school and the job and go somewhere where the winters were less severe and make some money. And I notified the old bachelor who ran the so-called Frosch House, a cooperative boarding house, that I was what I was gonna do. And he said, no, you're not. He said, tomorrow you go down and see Miss Martin, Julia Martin. And he says, she's got a job for you. So I became the houseboy for this elderly spinster who had rented rooms in her big home for single women. And my job was to fire the furnace and shovel the snow, which I did, and I received enough money to pay my food bill. And that was the third year, and I did that again the fourth year, and I also began selling life insurance in the fourth year. I didn't make a hell of a lot of money, but I made all I needed. And that's how I got out of university.
What year was that you graduated?
I graduated in 1930, in December. Because I was an irregular student, having started in the beginning without as much math as I should have had in my high school. But the degree was dated in June 1931.
Do you want any coffee?
I don't care for any. Thank you. So my degree is dated 1931. I was going to say something about that. Oh, I've been back for my university 50-year anniversaries twice. For the 1930, which is 1980 group, because those are all the people that I was in school with. And then I go again, I went again in 1981, because that's the date of my graduation. So
then you worked for Montana Power in 31 after that?
Yeah, I did. I worked in Montana Power in 1931 and 32 in their natural gas division. Now that was that might be an interesting comment historically. A company called Ohio Oil came to Montana proposing to bring gas from a field in Wyoming up through Montana, Red Lodge and other places, ending in Bozeman. And the city of Bozeman granted them a franchise. And they started work, and that's where I got my first job. And I got the job as a laborer. But when I went to start the job, the superintendent said, could you measure pipe? And I said, I think I could measure pipe. I thought he meant in the material yard or something. And he said, okay. He said, here's 100-foot tape. And here is a stack of 4x6 cards and a 6-inch ruler. And he said, I'll give you a man to hold the other end of the tape. Now you go out where we're laying the pipes and you measure where they put and draw a sketch on these cards with the dimensions so we can go back and dig them up later on if there's a problem. And that's what I did. And we're going along with that for about 5 months, nearing completion. And the Montana Power Company entered the picture. They didn't have any desire whatever.
You'll get all your lowdown on all of it.
Right. Montana Power was happy to be the producer of electrical power by hydroelectric stations. They were very comfortable with this situation. They didn't want to be in the natural gas business, but their parent company, which I think is Electric Bond and Share, or at least at that time, had made a survey and they decided that gas should be brought from the Cutbank gas field down through Helena and Anaconda to Bozeman and Livingston and so on. And so they came to the city of Bozeman and asked for a franchise, and the city gave it to them. So now the city is going to have two gas systems, which is ridiculous. And Electric Bond and Share brought in a construction company from Texas called Phoenix Utility. And they started to build a gas system, transmission line from Cut Bank, and distribution systems in every town like Bozeman. It was a power play by Ohio Oil. They knew that they were not going to stay and operate, but they sold out to the Montana Power Company's subsidiary. And at that stage, the chief engineer for the Phoenix Utility Company came up from Texas and he looked at what was going on at Bozeman. And he sought me out and he said, I understand you've been doing the surveys. And I said, well, I guess you could call it that. He says, show me your records. And I showed him this stack of cards now about that high. He says, I'll be damned. He said, we got to hire you as our chief engineer, chief of survey party, but you're not going to do it this way anymore. He said, you're going to have a survey party with an instrument man, a level man, a transit man, a draftsman, and a chainman, and we'll pay you $200 a month. This was big pay for me at that time. That's how I had a job prior to Fort Peck. And we continued doing the surveys for this work through the chain of Bozeman, Livingston, Big Timber, Columbus, and Upsarokee and Ridloss. And when that was all done, they took me into their headquarters in Butte. It's still, it was at that time as an entity called the Montana Power Company National Natural Gas Division. And I was given a job with a fancy title, the Assistant Superintendent of Natural Gas Utilization, which meant we were going to change all the burners in Helena and Anaconda and Butte that had been burning manufactured, we so-called city gas. Natural gas had twice as much heat in it, and we had to change the burners. As soon as all that burner work got changed, my job was finished. The Electric Bond and Share Company says, now Montana Power Company, it's yours, run it. And that's how they got into the gas business. And so I got a first job and ended it. Well, this is 1931 and 32.
And so that job ended in 32?
In the summer of 32. And I went and returned to Montana State then in the fall of 32 and completed 1 year of postgraduate study in June of 33. There was some other interludes there between June 33 and October 33. I did some harvesting of wheat at 15 cents an hour. I did a 6 weeks job of gold mining at Emigrant, Montana on the Yellowstone River, where I got 75 cents an hour. No, 75 cents a day and food. And we ran that mine for 6 weeks and cleaned up the gold and shipped it to Denver, and we got enough gold to pay our bills. So,
well, what was
that's before Fort Peck.
What was the situation in the state in 1932?
Well, the situation was that we were just beginning to feel the pinch of the economic depression. Actually, I had, in finishing my electrical engineering course in 1930, I was interviewed by recruiters from General Electric, Westinghouse, Western Electric, Bell Labs, who made it practice to come every year and interview the seniors. And they interviewed me, although I wasn't going to graduate. In June, they interviewed me. And I was selected by General Electric to come into their training course. That would have been about April, May or something in 1930. And it was understood that I wouldn't finish until December, and I couldn't come until January 31. Before that date arrived, I got a nice letter from General Electric with apologies, but they said, due to the economic crisis, it would be better if I could make other plans. That's the shortest job I ever had. I got it and lost it before I started to work.
Well, when did you come out to Fort Peck?
In October 1933. Actually, it was on the power line segment of about 28 miles from Harlem eastward. And at the moment, I'm not sure what that nearest town is. It might be Saco, I'm not sure. But at, no, I didn't say Harlem, that's wrong. Malta eastward, 28 mile section. And we did that work in October, November, and December. Weather was so cold that the ground was frozen. It was impossible to drive a wooden stake into the ground. And we had a solution for that. I didn't invent it, but there was a device, a wrought iron stake about the same size as the wooden stake. And you take that, and with a big sledgehammer, you drive it into the ground. And then you remove that and put the wood stake in it. Well, when that work was finished, then I actually had, like you might call, a holiday leave. And I was at home for Christmas and came back to Fort Peck. And I'm not sure the exact date, but sometime in February or March. And then I came right here to Fort Peck Dam.
How did you hear about the Fort Peck project down in Manhattan or Bozeman or wherever you were in 33?
It was big news. It was the biggest make-work project that it evolved under the Works Progress, WPA. Works something.
Or the Public Works Administration?
WPA, I think, is the initials, but it was the big program whereby the federal government put out of work people into jobs. But specifically, my entree was through the Montana Power Company. The Corps of Engineers approached the Montana Power Company after this sudden decision that Fort Peck Dam would be built as quickly as possible. It put lots of people to work. The Corps of Engineers approached Montana Power Company and they said, since electric power is going to come from Montana Power Company to the dam, we need a transmission line and we want you to help us survey it quickly. And so Montana Power Company set about to create 10 survey parties to work simultaneously. And the Montana Power Company called me and they said, we need you to head up a survey party. And then they explained they had all those party chiefs come for a meeting in Butte, I think, and I was there. And they explained what the design criteria would be for this power line. And they explained the background. It's because the Corps of Engineers is proceeding to build this dam. So it was no secret.
Did you pick up on the Montana Power's attitude towards the project?
I did. Oh, yes. It was well known that Montana Power at that stage was adamant that electric power would never be produced in Fort Peck Dam. And they had strong enough lobby that the Congress appropriated the money with a restriction that the construction of the power line from Great Falls to Fort Peck Dam should be only of a temporary design for an estimated 5-year life. It's the same power line that's running today. Because there's no way to build a power line for 5-year life in Montana, anyway. But they use wooden poles, wooden cross arms. But Montana's weather is such that they will last a long, long time. Then Montana Power, which was basically in bed with Anaconda all those years, they had a strong enough lobby to get another restriction on the Appropriation Act that required that at least half of the conductor for the transmission line would be of copper. So it was built, half of copper and the other half of aluminum.
On the line you were working on,
my role, I think this was the aluminum end, but my role, it didn't matter whether it was copper or aluminum. My role was just to pick the site where the structures should be built. But later on, as an inspector of construction here at the electrical construction at the dam, the electric conductors were all copper. A unique design of, I've forgotten the numbers now in circular mills, but the measure for the size of an electrical conductor is measured in circular mills and in dimensions that are more understandable, it's about as big as, thick as my finger. But the internal part was a twisted I-beam, and the outer part was a layer of round wires twisted in the opposite direction. And there had never been anything that heavy. Each circuit was to carry the power out to the dredges. Each circuit was 9 of those cables. just for one circuit. So yes, I knew that Montana Power, and everybody knew that Montana Power was sure they didn't need any more electric power. And before we got through building the dam, there was beginning to be a shortage of electric power in Montana. And approval was obtained, funds were appropriated to begin constructing the first hydroelectric generating station. And that was before I left in the fall of 1939. So I think construction actually began in a way 1940 or 41. He would start a bit earlier than that because I guess Montana Power didn't know or couldn't help maybe, but in building the four diversion tunnels, each one has a like a valve section and a vertical tower. They picked one of those as to be the future penstock for a hydroelectric generating plant. And the difference simply was that the liner of that one, from that central control valve downstream, the liner of that tunnel was made of steel, fixed steel, so it could withstand the hydrostatic pressure of the water flowing there and what would happen when they had to shut the turbine down. So there was that much was anticipated in the original design.
How long did you stay here?
From 1933 to 1939, October 39. And I would be on the payroll records till the 1st of December 1939. And I had accumulated leave time. So I actually left in October and spent 6 weeks in visiting family. And I had already obtained my next job, which was orders to active duty at the Boston Naval Shipyard. And I started there one December.
39. And this was, and so you became an engineer with the U.S. Navy?
Yes. It goes back, it overlaps my experience in Fort Peck. During my time in Fort Peck, there was an opportunity to apply for a written examination for a commission in the Corps of Engineers, second lieutenant, the lowest rank. And concurrently, there was an announcement of a similar nature for entry into the United States Navy Civil Engineer Corps in the rank of lieutenant, junior grade. And I competed in both of those. I took the one for the Army Corps of Engineers at Seattle in the fall of about 1936. And I was found not qualified physically. It was a crazy thing. But anyway, I reported there at my own expense, and I had to go to a doctor for medical. And he said, well, you have sinusitis and you'd be in the infirmary all the time. I won't approve. So I drove on to San Diego and took the Navy written exam. And I passed the physical. And it was a very lengthy and arduous engineering examination. 5 days, 8 hours a day, writing, solving problems. They were going to appoint 5 out of a field of 756. Well, I didn't get it. I was like 60, maybe. but it wasn't anywhere near, just five. And I thought nothing of it for another 6 months. I got a letter from the Navy Department, says, in view of your commendable showing in this examination, we'd be happy to give you a commission in the Naval Reserve Civil Engineer Corps, provided you will study our correspondence courses. And I said, what the hell? Sure, I did it. So I became an officer of the Navy Civil Engineer Corps Reserve in 1937. And then in 1939, out of a clear sky, they ordered me to active duty at Boston. And it fitted like the hand in a glove. I was just finishing my work at Fort Peck then.
Well, after you worked on the survey party, the power line section, and when you came back to Fort Peck, or came to Fort Peck, that would have been in 34?
34, yeah.
And what was the situation then?
The situation was indescribable. There were lots of people all waiting and hoping for a job, and grateful to get anything. Because the object is to put as many people to work as they could. So the first thing that went forward was the clearing of the reservoir area, cutting down trees. And that enabled them to put a lot of laborers to work fast. And then the other thing that was most urgent that they could do immediately, or had to do immediately, was surveying. And surveying for the town site, buildings, utilities, water, gas. And I guess we didn't have gas. Water and sewage, the substation for electrical and so on. It was basically what the Corps called a force account, I think, where people were hired to work on the rolls as civilian employees of the Army Corps of Engineers. And they used that format insofar as they could, but they soon recognized that certain parts of the work would best be done by putting it under contract. So there was a big contract for the diversion tunnels. There was a separate big contract for the steel diaphragm wall. A separate contract for the spillway. And one of the first big contracts, strangely to some people, was the removal and stripping of earth from the dam. Because it wasn't considered acceptable to build the dam on any material that had roots and stumps and vegetable matter in it. So they stripped 4 million cubic yards of earth before they started to put it in the dam.
Why wasn't that considered acceptable?
Because it might violate the integrity of the structure. See, it's to be an earthen dam, and you had to be sure that it was watertight. And if you would lay down the dam on an area that had been lots of vegetable matter, there would be possibly a porous lens through which water could seep and maybe gradually increase its flow until the point where the dam could fail.
So before any dredging began,
Well, before any dredging began, we had to build the dredges. The dredges were constructed right here. Four dredges, four floating booster plants, and four land-based boosting plants. So we had four separate and distinct dredging lines operating continuously, almost continuously, for the first 2 years. And then we had an unforeseen development was that some of the area that was considered to be suitable to borrow the earth from turned out to be unsuitable because it had not the right proportion of sand and gravel to silt. So as the dam got higher, we had to go farther and farther away. So the four dredging units were combined to make two dredging units, each with 10 pumps instead of 5. So one of the four dredges was converted to a booster station. In the beginning, I had a dredge with 2 units, over here a floating unit with two pumps, and over here at the toe of the dam, one more pump. Now we stretch that out twice as long with one dredge becoming a booster. And then it would be 2 floating boosters and 2 land-based boosters. My work on that dredging, first I was a watch engineer on the dredge Missouri. And later, when their chief engineer resigned, I was promoted to be the chief engineer on Dredge, Missouri. Then later, when they combined 2 dredging units, the Dredge, Missouri and the Dredge, Jefferson, I believe, I became the chief engineer on that combination. And I continued in that category until the end of dredging.
But first you were inspecting electrical construction?
Yes, but that was only a matter of a few months. And then there was the construction of the dredges, and that was a matter of only a few months. Less than a year.
Now you were inspecting the construction of the dredges or the electrical?
No, well, I don't know. I think technically I was on the payroll as an engineman, probably, looking ahead to completion when we would be operating. And frankly, I don't remember the day-by-day things I did while we were building those dredges, but it would have been with regard to the machinery, the pumping and the electrical driving machinery versus the other part of the dredging was the heavy ladder construction and barge construction.
Where were the materials coming from? I mean, did you have anything to do with
I didn't have anything to do with buying materials, but I think the pumps the pumps and the motors had different sorts, I think. And I'm not sure who produced the pumps. But I believe it was General Electric who built these special big motors and the related switchgear equipment. I'm not sure of that, though.
Well, how well organized was the project from your perspective? Were materials arriving on time?
From my point of view, it was well organized and well executed. The only big problem was a failure in the structure, which is generally referred to as the big slide. And that, that added another year of dredging.
Well,
project should have been a 4-year job and became a 5-year job. 5+. And it was attributed, I believe, to the final analysis, to an inadequate subsurface examination prior to completing the design. The slide that happened was because material underneath the dam became fluid and pushed its way upstream into the lake, and that allowed all the overburden on it to ride on out. That would have been avoided had the designers realized the exact nature of the soil down deep. And after they found it out, the cure for it was to flatten the slopes of the dam, which means making the cross sections of the dam wider at the bottom than it was in the beginning, thereby distributing the weight of the dam over a greater base area. So that was a problem, unanticipated, that slowed us down.
Now, when you say a lack of examination of the subsurface in the design,
yeah.
The design as it was progressing, or?
No, the first thing that was done was to take samples by core drilling or other means of sampling, and that was done probably on a grid of 100 feet. In other words, on lines 100 feet apart, every 100 feet along the line would be a test hole, and it should have been taken deep enough to find out exactly what kind of material was there. Now, by hindsight, it appears that needed to have been done on a finer grid and maybe to a greater depth. I had, in my role as an engineer on the dredge, I had nothing to do with that, with the design or the testing of what caused it. But I was an interested observer to find out what happened. This failure occurred, I don't know the date in my mind right now, but it was late in the fall, I think. And to actually find out what happened, we set up freezer plants where a ring of vertical test holes were put down, and inside each of those test holes was a pipe, U-pipe, that carried refrigerant so you could freeze the earth. And they, in effect, by that means, they were able to freeze a core of earth, oh, maybe 10, 20 feet diameter, I'm not sure, way down deep. Then they set up and took a massive size core drill of frozen material, and they laid it out in a shed, each one of these cores in a shed, in the same order they took them out of the ground. And they didn't have to refrigerate those because it was the winter time and frozen all the time. So the experts could now go and see exactly what kind of material was in this slide, including what was underneath the slide. And they had experts in soil mechanics, all of the recognized big experts from the United States. It was a board I think of 20 members, I'm not sure. Again, it was beyond my province. I was just an interested observer.
Well, were you on ship when that occurred?
At this stage, I had become the chief engineer, and all my work was day shift. But the people working for me were on revolving ships. Well, this failure occurred in the, in the daytime, and one of my pumping stations, which I didn't mention earlier, one of my pumping stations was floating in the core pool. That's how, after the main section of the dam was closed, put all the water through the diversion tunnels, then there was the core pool settling basin that you had to pump water out of. And one of my stations, one of my pumps, was in there with a pipeline going out and over the edge of the dam. But it was only, the pumping station was only maybe 100 feet off the edge. That and that was in the area that failed. And this failure took place like that. That pumping station was never seen again. The two fellows on it, or should have been on it, were not on it. They had walked ashore to eat their lunch, I think. And I couldn't really blame them. But they should never have left their station, because there's... But that particular pumping station was not critical. The others that were delivering material from the dredge bar area into the dam, it was critical that the telephone be manned all the time. But this other one, it wasn't critical. And anyway, they had taken it on their own to be off the boat. And while they were off the boat was lost completely. Never a sprig of it seen again.
Now, how big were these pumping stations?
Well, this floating pumping station was well, I think the barge is about 40 feet wide and 100 feet long, but maybe less. Maybe less. They weren't small. Not at all.
Amazing. But, would be, just
disappear. So, and nobody criticized them for not being on the boat. But they should have been on the boat.
Well, were you on one of the other boats at the time?
No, as I remember it, I was... Yeah, I guess it probably was. I'm not sure. But I think it happened around 1 o'clock p.m., and at that time, I was probably just back aboard one of the dredges. But in those days, I came home for lunch. We had the dredging, the top echelon of dredging was the dredge master and his chief engineer. We were a pair. And I was paired first with a master named Blomqvist, a big, heavy Norwegian, I think. Later, I was with Master Joe Donovan, an Irishman from Olympia, Washington. And finally, I was with Raul Andre. He was, I think, I don't know if he came from Montana or not. There's some interesting side story. To after the dam was completed, well, let me say first, during construction of the dam, we had by far and away the largest aggregation of hydraulic dredging that had ever been assembled anywhere. And I think it was the first time that dredge pumps had been operated in multiple. Certainly never did you have, as we did, a minimum of five 2,500 horsepower pumps in series. It was unique. After the war, after the construction was completed, these dredging people scattered to the four winds. And two of the skippers that I had worked with went on a dredging job at Wake Island, where they were dredging to increase the amount of land space or something, probably anticipating World War II. Not much doubt about it. Two of those skippers were there, Raoul Andre and Joe Donovan. They were still there working as civilian constructors and when the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor. And they were there when the Marines, there was a company of Marines. In my mind, I wasn't there, but I think 100 more or less of Marines and 100 more or less of civilian construction workers. And the Marines got lots of publicity for holding off the Japanese attack. Unprecedented that people could on shore hold off a destroyer. But they did wonderfully well. But it was not just the Marines, it was these, civilian people too. But the Japanese won, and they put the American civilians in to work as enslaved laborers on the island. And that went on for, 2 years, and when we were rolling back in World War II, to get that island back. I have this as a first-hand report from Joe Dunham. Excuse me. The Japanese lined them up, and by some formula that he never knew, they picked half of them and shot them. Andre was one of those. Joe Donovan was shipped to Japan, where he worked as a slave labor on the construction of a hydroelectric power plant. And I got all this after the war when I visited with Joe Donovan. And I asked him how they treated him. And he said, they treated us well by their standards. Joe said he saw Americans die of starvation because they couldn't eat fish heads and rice. But he ate the fish heads and the rice and survived. Well, I guess that's it.
Dredge master and the job of chief engineer.
Yeah. Well, yes. The organization, the dredge master, is analogous to the captain of a seagoing ship. And the chief engineer is analogous to the chief engineer on a ship. The dredge master had direct control over the lever man who sits in the con tower and pulls the levers to make the dredge swing right and left, the ladder go up and down. And the engineman is down in the engine room starting and stopping the pumps as necessary. It sounds pretty simple, but the whole aggregation was not so simple. It was analogous maybe to a freight train. If you can imagine a freight train having a locomotive at the front and periodically, two locomotives at the front and then a space down about in the middle, two more locomotives, and on the end a locomotive. and these are all pulling loaded cars. In effect, that's what this pump line has. And we had to learn some hard lessons about operation. As you were working along, digging into a bank of sand and gravel that's 40 feet below the surface and maybe 20 feet above the surface, sometimes those banks would slide off and completely bury the intake line of this suction line. And immediately, all these five pumps are pulling, and they're full of vacuum. And if then, when you move the dredge to get a release, whammo, it goes with water hammer. And we lost some pumps, great big pumps, just split in half like that. Until we learned how to avoid it. One way was we put a trap door in the suction line down fairly near to the end, but back about 12 feet, I think. And that was controlled by compressed air. And the leverman, watching what's happening, when he sees the bank fall, and then he's got a pressure gauge on the wall, and he sees it starts to draw a heavier vacuum than it was, he steps on a button, and that opens this butterfly valve and lets clear water come in, and you avoid the water hammer. Related to that problem, we sunk a floating booster station when one of those surges came, and it burst in two parts, one of the pumps on the booster station. And this flow is a 28-inch diameter pipe with water, sand, and gravel, a ratio of about 20% sand and gravel. And the minute that pump burst on the floating booster, all the sand and gravel starts piling on top. Even though the deck was waterproof, the extra weight put it under. So that only happened once. We devised a simple scheme. And this was the engineman's role on the booster station. If the instant that happens, he pushed a button which short-circuited the power line at the substation that was supplying power to the dredges and all the pumps. So we could shut down instantly if necessary. The day-by-day routine work was one thing, but periodically we had to shut down, remove the pumps, and replace certain parts that would wear fast. Sand and gravel is very abrasive. And we began doing that kind of thing and allowing about 12 hours to get it done. And we improved until finally, I think one time was done in just under 60 minutes. We learned a lot.
Well, were there some other obstacles or problems you faced?
Well, the weather. Because the temperature got so low, we continued to dredge as long as we could in the fall. And because the dredge was in motion, working 24 hours a day, and it was in motion, the ice couldn't form in big, thick blocks very easily. But it reached a point where we had to stop. Generally, we were stopped for 2 months in the winter. After the ice got to be 3 feet thick, then we'd stop. And it fitted in with the administrative situation. There was no way to pay anyone overtime, premium pay. So people had two accounts. Here's straight time account and your compensatory time account. So what at normal times nowadays would be overtime pay, overtime hours or comp hours, and we were allowed to take those at straight time pay during the winter.
Nice.
So we worked around the clock all the time during construction phase. And we earned no extra pay, but we got time off with pay.
So when you shut down the dredges, generally would you leave for a couple of months?
The first time I took this trip to Seattle and on down the West Coast, taking these two exams, that was my honeymoon. We had married in June, but we didn't have any honeymoon. The next year, we took a winter trip down through Bryce and Zion and the Grand Canyon and Tucson, Arizona. I don't remember what we did another year, but every year we went somewhere.
And the, who comprised the crews of these dredges? Were these people with some navigational or dredging experience, boatmen?
Well, good question. The dredge masters were men who had a lot of experience in dredging. The Leverman was always a man with a lot of prior experience. Then the first mate, I guess that's all we had, any crew was the first mate. He probably had some waterfront experience before, but the deckhands were unskilled labor who were trained in being deckhands. Now in the engine room, the engineer, I guess I should call him an engine man, but we, in those days they were called the engineer and then his assistant was called a striker. In normal times, they would have been non-professional people, maybe an electrician or a mechanic. Lots of different kinds of people who might have gotten those jobs. But because the